Hei og velkommen til en ny episode av Pareto-podden. Den gangen her så det biotech og helseaksjer vi skal rette søkelyset vårt mot I anledning til at vi den 1. Og 2. September ber inn alle våre kunder til vårt årlige seminar for helseaksjer. Der får du lære litt mer om de over 60 nordiske helseselskapene som skal presentere, og for å snakke litt overordnet om sektoren og gi en liten guide for hvordan du kan navigere seg rundt I en kanskje litt vanskelige biotech-verden, så har jeg med meg fra Stockholm en av Paretos life science og helseanalytikere, Dan Akshuti. Velkommen så mye, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Dan, you're originally Swiss, so we'll do the podcast in English. And to start off a bit, could you tell us a bit about your background? Because most equity analysts have an education and background within business or finance or economics, but within life science, that's not often the case. How did you end up as a stock analyst as in life science at Pareto?
Yeah, exactly. So my background is in molecular biology. So that's a focus on the nucleotides like DNA, RNA stuff. And then I worked in drug development at Novartis Pharma. That's a global pharmaceutical company headquartered in Basel, Switzerland. And after around 6.5 years, I got more and more interested also in the stock market and started investing also privately in some US biotechs around clinical trial news. And yeah, I think that was kind of the start of that move into now being a sell side analyst at Pareto.
I guess it's an advantage to be medically educated, but is it an essential necessity in assessing these companies, do you think?
I would say so. Maybe you don't need to have university degrees or whatever. I think you if you're really interested, you can learn a lot just going through some books or whatever yourself. I think it's really critical actually to have some understanding of the specificities in this sector, because else the companies can sell you everything and you can't really understand it. And unfortunately, there are many companies that are not very honest, or maybe oversell things or do things wrong. And I think that's I think where it becomes really critical actually to have some specialist knowledge, and oftentimes the financial knowledge is very secondary, because if you're looking at the, I don't know, some cancer drug, if the drug really works strongly, the market is there, so it's going to sell for a lot, and then the financial analyst part can maybe assess how much it will be able to generate. But even that part actually needs the kind of disease area knowledge and knowledge of the other drugs and how effective it is, because all these things affect in the end sales. So I think that is in the end more important, because the markets usually are there. It's more a question, are these companies ever going to make it to the market or not?
Yeah, so even as a private investor, it's possible to be self-learned in the life science sector as well.
Yeah, I think you don't need to understand every little detail of how, I don't know, cells work and everything. But I think you need to understand the disease area. You need to understand what drugs are given to these patients currently, how clinical trials are conducted, and what is good and what is not good, so that you can actually understand that. But you don't need the little small details and understanding everything about the chemistry or whatever, except you want to invest very, very early in these companies, but then usually it's not the publicly traded companies.
Yeah, you're a part of our health life science team in Stockholm. In the Pareto group, where it numbers four people. It's three in Stockholm and one in Frankfurt. What sort of companies do you guys mainly cover?
Exactly. Yeah. So I think we have Christian Lee, for instance. He's focused on medtech companies. There, I think it's usually easier to understand the value proposition, and but then these companies also can have lots of challenges actually selling once they reach the market, but the way to the market is less risky maybe than with drugs.
What's a typical med tech company or a med tech product?
We have, for instance, Mentis under coverage where we did, I think, the IPO. So they're selling a kind of software to, and also like a simulator to have like surgeons test kind of or do a surgery in a simulator before actually doing it in the patient.
Yeah.
So that is a kind of a medtech product. And you have other companies like Sedana, I think a stock that has performed very well that we had on the coverage, which is changing kind of the way on how you sedate people in the hospitals. So it's a much more convenient device. So it's usually medtech is something, it's some sort of device. It's not a drug.
Hmm. And in our life science team, the coverage is often on small growth companies, not always on the big medical conglomerates.
Yeah, exactly. So we have, I think, the more or less bigger companies that we have on the coverage are by Peter Estling with Sobi, for instance. But we cover mainly the small ones. They are, I think, more interesting to many investors because you can have usually much higher returns if it goes well. The returns are usually x-fold. And at the same time, it goes a bit hand in hand, I guess, with the business of Pareto. So we are looking at the companies that we like from an analyst perspective. And then the banking side also gets that kind of confirmation that if the analysts like it, it's likely a good case. So they try to work with these companies and in the end, everyone benefits. And our clients, I think, have been also quite happy by the returns they managed to get from our transactions as well.
And Dan, you have followed the Nordic healthcare sector for a while now. What are some of the hallmarks of the sector here in the Nordics?
I think it's what is quite special is that you have, especially in Sweden, you have a lot of great research. You have lots of small companies, which you, for instance, in Switzerland don't have. There are a few small ones, but they're mainly these two big pharma giants and some other offices of other big companies. But in Sweden and also Norway, a few in Finland and Denmark, you do have lots of small companies, and oftentimes they have a very, very good research. And then unfortunately, I think where it lacks sometimes is on the management side, and then it becomes difficult to like take the drugs from research into drug development. So it's one thing to find something really good. It's another really big challenge to make a drug out of it. Mm. And then get it to the market. And I think that's where I saw the biggest issue in some of the companies, where I guess there's just sometimes a bit of lack of experience. But I think the research is quite great. And I think we also through Pareto can really help these companies to move forward, because there has been also a bit of a difference, I would say, between US, for instance, in terms of funding. So, I mean, you do get better management and maybe also better scientists on board if you have more money in the company. And I think there has been a big discrepancy between US and Nordic companies that there was much more, there are much more funds available in the US than here, but this has been changing now.
And now with the coronavirus pandemic, it has shifted interest over to the healthcare sector. Do you kind of feel a bit more investor interest in the sector that you're covering now versus before the coronavirus pandemic?
I think that certainly helped us as well, in a sense, to sound bad, but I think that certainly helped to get more interest into healthcare. Because again, like it shows, like even during the financial crisis, which was not the health crisis, you could see how the sector was one of the most resilient ones. The healthcare, usually people like to spend money on healthcare first. Luxury goods sometimes also do well in crises. And now it was a health crisis. So you could see after the initial drop in spring 2020, the healthcare indexes were trading fast higher than before the drop. And I think that shows the resilience and the kind of strength of this market, and then brought a lot of, I think, also more retail interest last year. Many people opened up new accounts, and healthcare was the hot topic in the year. So I guess that also made the market a bit more volatile in healthcare stocks, which again makes it, I think, more interesting for those stock pickers that really understand the stocks, because then they can benefit of these kind of market inefficiencies created through high volatility that you can also buy in and sell at good points. But overall, I would say it's not just the pandemic. I think overall we can see that the sector is maturing here, and we are managing to really help these companies get access to more and more capital, also from big specialist funds in the US and elsewhere. And I think that is kind of unrelated to COVID. We can see this increase and become closer to the yes.
And you're based in Sweden, of course, and Sweden is the hub for Nordic healthcare stocks. But there's also a cluster here in Norway, especially within biotech stocks. Although we don't have analyst coverage on too many of them yet, but the lineup is strong with names like Nordic Nanovector, Targovax, Vaccibody, Bergen Bio, Ultimovax. Why is there so many of these companies listed here in Norway?
Yeah, I think also Norway has great universities there. And there is great research. And you can see probably it's like an earlier version to me, of what happened in Sweden now happening in Norway. So you have more and more research coming into these companies like the ones you mentioned, and OncoInvent, I think also. And I think that it's some research coming out of the hospitals sometimes in Norway, and that is now slowly moving into making products out of it. So I think it's mainly comes from good universities and good research. And I guess also there, I think there is some work to do in funding and also building proper management teams that can focus on the right things and bring it forward fast. I think that has been also a big issue in Sweden, that certain companies have been much slower than their US peers. And even if you have great research and maybe in some cases you're ahead of others, if you're not fast enough, someone else will catch up. So I think that is something that probably still also needs some work in Norway to bring these companies forward a bit faster.
Yeah, and for the average retail investor, it might be, as you said, hard to evaluate what sort of companies are going to do well, and that's something we're going to dive a bit deeper into here today. What to look for and how to assess these complex stocks and products. So might just start out there, Dan. How do you as a life science analyst evaluate those sorts of companies? What do you look for?
I think in general, many people perceive biotech stocks as very risky, and they are in a sense, and one should never just invest in one company and also not get in love with a company. If something is going wrong or really not moving as it should, then one should take the consequences. But if you have a bunch of good companies, so you can see that the sector actually really outperforms others. But then, yeah, what you look at, I think, is that you should really look at each company individually. And it's important to think critically about everything. So analyze every piece of information with a critical perspective, and that you don't take anything at face value. Like the most serious looking management team could sell you something that is not correct. I think that is something that you unfortunately really need to think about all the time. So
you have to have in the back of your head that the management might be trying to fool you then.
Either that, or that they are not done, that they are kind of did something wrong and presenting it in a right way. But if you actually dig into the details, you will see that there is something wrong. So you should be just have a very critical mindset when you look at these companies.
Mm.
And what helps, I think, in the beginning that you save maybe some time is to look for any sign of a past kind of corrupt behavior or bad behavior of the company or the current management team. Sometimes it was run by a bad management team in the past, and now there's a new management team. And then the company might trade very low, even though now it's actually a good case. So that also creates a nice discount based on a bad past. So you can find out these things if you look at the company's past and current management.
Yeah.
Because
in many of these companies, it's quite a lean management teams. You know, many companies are just growth companies who are only burning cash to perhaps have some product to sell in the future. So they're just burning cash. Does that make the well, of course, management is always important in a company, but is it possible to say that it's more important in life science and biotech companies?
Yeah, I think it in the end, it's really you need to look at these companies holistically. So it's the management that is important, the science is important, the financial prospects are important. If they are going for some indication where there are like tons of competitors, big pharma competitors, their drug is not very innovative, but the management is great and the clinical trials are great, it will still not be a good case. And there are some examples like that without mentioning names. So you kind of can't get around of looking at everything, and everything has to be good to make it a good case. And yeah, I guess management is in most cases the issue. But in some cases, it's the opposite. The science is actually very boring and the management is great. And then usually what happens is they manage to pump up the stock a lot and move forward a lot, and then in the end, the awakening comes sooner or later. So it's really important to understand the clinical area in which the company is going. Like, is it some, I don't know, rare lung disease? What are the drugs currently there? What is the market size? Does it look reimbursement-wise? And then how are the prospects of the drug? So what data is out there already? I think for more, less specialized investors, it's good to wait until maybe phase two data is out. So that's usually the clinical phase where the drug shows some efficacy, safety and efficacy. And it's still maybe not easy to read, but it's much easier to read than what comes before that.
Yeah.
And if that looks good and you can compare it maybe to some others, then it becomes maybe a good case. And of course, again, like everything has to be looked at holistically. So you need to look at the valuation. Is it already high? Is it still very low? And I think there you can use relative valuation as well. DCF makes sense to a certain extent. But I think in the end, there is no way around hard work, I guess. Like if you really want to get a good amount of alpha, you will have to do the hard work and do some due diligence in the kind of business factors, the scientific factors, and also the financial prospects. And then maybe wait for enough puzzle pieces of the case to come together that you can actually see the picture of the puzzle, the outcome, even without all puzzle pieces, and then maybe you can still get the get into the stock at a fairly low valuation with much less risk than maybe if you go very early when you're more unsure where it needs more and more specialized knowledge.
Yeah, because you mentioned phase two here as a good entry point for the more novice investor. Most medicines, I get the feeling of, is developing in these phases. Can you take us through how a new medicine or product in healthcare is developed? What are these phases?
I mean, there is this textbook approach where you start with a phase one trial, then you have a phase two trial, and then a phase three. And the phase one looks at the safety of the drug, sometimes in healthy volunteers, sometimes already in patients. Then the phase two trial will look at the safety and efficacy and also test more doses. So the phase one might also test already the maximum tolerable dose. But it might also occur only in phase two. And then in phase two, you might have three doses of a drug and you have more patients and you will see, okay, the higher the dose, the better the effect. That gives you some confidence that the drug is actually working. At the same time, you can maybe rule out that the drug is very toxic, or at least the risk is reduced. And then in the phase three trial, you test the drug at the usually one specific dose. It can also still be more than one at a much larger patient population or different intervals of dosing, maybe weekly or monthly. But now these phases have been more and more actually been kind of become intertwined. So many trials in oncology are phase one, two trials. So they combine these two phases to then go faster into a phase three. So the aim is to get the drugs faster to the market, because some of these trials might, if you want to do it very plastic in some indications, it might take forever. Could take, in some cases can take maybe up to 10 years. And then if you're going for small indications, rare diseases, you also don't have the amount of patient population to run a normal phase three. So the regulatory authorities, the European Medicines Agency and the US Food and Drug Administration, FDA, have become much more flexible. If you have a good value proposition and a good plan to that shows that your drug is safe and effective, you might get much faster actually to the market than historically.
Yeah. So in general, the market risk decreases substantially as the company or product goes further in the development stage and moves through these phases.
Yeah, I would say so. And then you can take some examples, like if you have in idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, for instance, IPF, it's a lung disease. You have two drugs on the market right now. They're selling for a few billion dollars. And you can see that their effect they had in their clinical trials. And then you have a new company coming, let's say Vicore Pharma, a Swedish company. Then once they have phase two data out, you will be able to compare that data a bit to the others. There will be differences between the clinical trials, but you can compare. And if it does look better, it still doesn't mean that this drug will for sure get to the market, but I would say the prospects then have become much better. And if then this company is trading maybe just at the 1-2 billion SEK valuation, but potentially if it reaches the market is multi-billion dollars in sales, then you can kind of guesstimate a bit the upside even without doing a DCF. Or you look at M&A in the area where, for instance, Intermune, a company, has been acquired by Roche, a big pharmaceutical company, for I think six point something billion dollars after phase three data.
Is that a goal for many companies to be acquired by a larger pharmaceutical group? Is that something they actively pursue? Or is it more kind of like a bonus?
More a bonus, I would say, and it should be more a bonus in the company's heads. Because if they aim at this, then usually the deal that they strike will be less good. But if a company aims at doing everything themselves, then usually they manage to negotiate good deals. We have seen some very good deals recently by, for instance, the US biotech company Atieos Therapeutics managed to get a very good deal with GSK, a lot of upfront, I think over $600 million upfront, while still retaining a lot of future value with high royalties on sales in case the drug reaches the market. And I think that if your area has a bit of a hype, like the molecules you have or the targets you're going after, plus you're just focusing on doing it yourself, then you're in a strong position to negotiate good deals with pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah. So M&A or mergers and acquisition, is that something you build into your models, or is it something that you try to overlook when you're assessing a company?
Personally, I try to not overlook it, but I don't build it in my models. But there are some cases where you just know it will be acquired. Like pharma will not sit there and just let this company do its thing. So like the one we mentioned now in IPF, you have a Roche there on the market making billions, and you have Boehringer Ingelheim making billions. Now, if a third player comes, a small company that has stronger data than their drugs, one of the two or a third player that wants to take the business from the other two will come and try to get it. So that's just kind of almost common sense. But usually it happens later. I mean, there are some early examples, but the pharma companies usually prefer to pay a lot, but later. And that's not per se risk that they are worse, but more like that. Actually, from my experience also at Novartis, it's that you simply don't have the FTEs, like the employees, to work on these projects. So it's you prefer to get them late and just put it into the commercial functions in a company. And if you look at the latest M&As, at least from or deals from Novartis, it has been primarily post phase 3 data or even post market approval. But some other companies are different. And if it's a very hot area and very strong clinical data, that's where really the value comes, is from clinical data, meaning, let's say, a deadly disease. We can use the IPF example again, like patients die within 3 to 5 years, even when taking the two marketed drugs that are making billions. If you're coming with a drug and you're showing in a clinical trial that, hey, you stop the progression of the disease and in 100 patients, I mean, that's kind of a dead giveaway that this is there is a lot of value in such a drug.
And the M&A is often a very nice trip for investors as well. So many investors are they looking for healthcare companies that might be bought up, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I remember Lox Oncology a bit earlier. They went up to $4 billion in market cap, and then later they were bought for over $8 billion by Eli Lilly. So I think that is something that can really happen, but you don't need to wait for it. If you look at other companies, well, when they post good data, like Mirati Therapeutics started to post good data of their drugs in 2017, it was still valued at around $150, $200 million. It multiplied over 20-fold over the next 3 years. So you don't need to have M&A happening to have very good returns if the drugs are promising.
Yeah.
But I think it's something that is... Yeah, it's just something that happens to these companies, but should it be the focus of when you look at these companies? I think not. You should just look at the, is it really a promising company? Does it have a drug that could sell for a lot? Is the valuation still fairly low? And then it might be interesting. And of course, timing-wise, it's always a bit difficult to say when is the right timing, but if you can see that there are quite some catalysts coming up, like that the company will report clinical data, which are usually the biggest catalysts for these companies. Then usually it's maybe a good point to go in if you want to take the risk. Or else afterwards, if you want to take less risk. But it depends really from each case.
Yeah, absolutely. If we are to take a bit of a step back, you have had your eyes on the sector for years now. What trends do you see emerging in the healthcare sector nowadays? What's going to be hot in the coming years, you think?
Yeah, I think there's right now it's tough to say something new right now, because what we have seen now, this kind of new wave of gene therapies as well, but it's going down again. Like Bluebird, for instance, pulled their like commercial sales force away from Europe because of tough pricing discussions. They want a few million dollars for each treatment, and that's tough to get, and at least in Europe. So I think this is cooling off a bit again, gene therapy. You could see that as well, like the valuations were really high in 2018, 19, and then they started to decrease constantly. Maybe they are now again cheap, but one has to be careful which to pick from these gene therapy companies. Few exceptions are CRISPR companies. They have been hyped a lot, which is also why there has been a lot of success already priced into these companies. So that I would say they are more or less valued quite high. mRNA companies, there are many different types of RNA, not just the messenger RNA, mRNA. There are short interfering RNAs.
That's the same stuff that the Moderna and Pfizer coronavirus vaccines was made of, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's in a way a beautiful thing, because it's so much simpler than the normal vaccines. You can easily, like, I think Moderna took 4 to 6 weeks to basically identify the target and produce it. So, because it's in the end, it's just a sequence. It's a sequence of kind of sugary molecules. So there's a big sugar part in these nucleotides, these bases that make up our DNA, and for RNA it's slightly different, but fairly similar, and so it's very easy to do, while the classical vaccines are much more difficult to produce, and they actually are also inherently more risky, because you do have different kind of complex components in the classical vaccines that you don't have with the RNA vaccines. It's a sequence, and then you add fat to it, basically you add phospholipids for the delivery that it is taken up into the cells, and these lipids, they are we already have them in the body, and they originate. They usually take it, I think, from soy or egg yolk from chicken eggs. Mm. And so there is, I think, they're much simpler and yet I think very effective. And in future, you will have more cocktails as well, so that you can just add a cocktail of sequences in there. And we really have built quite an understanding. I remember like working on this in 2011 already with short interfering RNAs, that sequence repeats, they can be very immunogenic, so that you trigger a too strong immune reaction. But there has been now a lot of knowledge generated there, and computers models are used to see which sequence could be too dangerous, and then they can just adjust it. And then you could see now with both Pfizer and Moderna, I think that these vaccines are very safe, and I think that's quite a big step. And you can see this technology employed also more and more in oncology and other diseases. Alnylam, actually, U.S. biotech, was the first to get the approval in 2018 for a certain disease. And ever since, it has been quite interesting. And those people that were interested in that technology earlier, they could, for instance, buy Moderna, which was focused on oncology, actually, already in 2019, looking at their other portfolio. Currently, these companies are, of course, now most of them are higher valued, but I think you can still maybe scoop up some of the smaller ones that have an innovative twist to their technology.
And many of them will present at our healthcare conference on the 1st and 2nd of September. What's there to look forward to on the conference, you think?
Yeah, I think we have this year a record of 67 companies, if I'm not mistaken here. I think there are lots of interesting companies. But to look forward specifically, I think if you look at some of the promising companies that are getting from a more like less specialist perspective, maybe those that get to the market soon, like Calliditas, for instance, they will have their approval date on the 15th of September. They're still fairly cheap. So one that doesn't want to take the approval risk can get now a first overview of the company at the conference and then maybe wait until the 15th for the approval or buy before if they are confident. But likely it's even still fairly cheap after approval. Because that is a drug, for instance, that has currently there is no treatment for these patients on the market. So it will be the first drug approved for a big indication where patients are losing their kidney function over time. And I think there the market is there. There's currently no competitor on the market. There's, I think, earliest next summer one to reach the market. So I think this kind of clarity of data, value proposition is there, close to the market, and still valued fairly low. I think that they can be very interesting to look at. But then, of course, those that want to get in even earlier and get are interested in big return, potential returns, and want to take a bit more risk, they can also look at the more early stage companies. But I think we have quite an interesting lineup with lots of companies advancing a lot, like BioInvent will have four clinical catalysts over the coming, let's say 6 to maximum 8 months, also valued fairly cheap. More than half of the market cap is just cash. I think that is also interesting to look at, but many other companies as well. It's a very interesting lineup of companies, and of course everyone can tune in and ask questions.
Yeah, all Pareto customers are more than welcome to join our digital healthcare conference on the 1st and the 2nd of September. Dan Akshuti, thank you so much for your run through of the healthcare and biotech sector.
Thank you very much for having me, Ola.
Hej, det här är Matilda Karlsson från Pareto Securities i Stockholm. Vi har även en svensk podd och varje onsdag så kommer det ett nytt avsnitt där jag pratar med olika investerare och förvaltare. Så passa på att lära lite mer om den svenska aktiemarknaden och lyssna på Pareto Podcast i din podcast-app.
Og så minner vi om at informasjonen i podcasten her ikke må ses på som investeringsråd. Plasseringer i verdipapirer medfører til enhver tid risiko, og historisk avkastning ingen garanti for fremtidig avkastning.